Chapter 11. Lacking due respect to the king. Laurent.
Our excitement over the initial forensic successes was tempered by news out of the Kingdom of Morocco that same week in March 2021.
The judge in Casablanca had just concluded his preliminary investigation and signed off on formal charges in the case of Omar Radi. The investigating judge had essentially rubber-stamped the prosecution's flimsy allegations while vitiating evidence and witness testimony crucial to the defense. He had even charged the key defense witness as an accomplice in one of the alleged crimes. Omar, who had been jailed for 8 months while the Moroccan judge weighed evidence, was now facing trial on two separate counts: undermining the security of the state and rape. If convicted, he can be in prison for another 5 years or even 10. This was the latest in a series of sharp blows to the 34-year-old journalist, who had made it a point of personal pride to expose powerful interests in Morocco who jealously hoarded the kingdom's treasure, its political power, its security forces, and its legal system. Omar was not happy unless he was doing risky investigations and working on topics that disturb those who hold power, one of his friends explained. He was passionate about understanding and disclosing ongoing processes of theft and robbery of impoverished people in their territories, their lands, water, and sand. Omar was a trained economist, an experienced investigator, and a clear and fluid writer. He was also fluent in French, English, and Arabic. He could have taken up residence in London or Amsterdam or Paris and done his editorializing against the predations of the Moroccan state at a safe remove. But Omar had done his work at home, in broad daylight, for all to see.
"It makes sense for me to stay in Morocco," Omar explained to a colleague who asked why he didn't live in exile.
"Other people have done this, but for me, it's not really an option. There are struggles to be made in Morocco, and I want to be part of it. Struggles for freedom of expression, but also for freedom of organizing and the freedom of people." That stubborn insistence to remain home, to speak truth to power in the seat of national government, and to advocate for Moroccans who had no voice, had put him in very real peril. He was facing another round of public shaming and the likelihood of real time in prison. The development in the Omar case that week in March was also a blow to the Pegasus Project. Morocco was one of the key lines of inquiry that Sandrine and I had settled on with our first circle of partners. The data on the leaked list suggested that the NSO client in Morocco had been the most active user of Pegasus outside of Mexico. There appeared to be thousands of people selected for targeting by somebody in Morocco. Among the targets selected were officials from foreign governments, including at least a dozen in the Macron administration in France, as well as political dissidents, human rights defenders, and scores of working journalists within Morocco and without. The journalists could have been our perfect wedge into the story there, but we were already wary of including a media partner from inside the country. The danger of exposure was just too high for us and for any journalist working in Casablanca or Rabat. Reporters and editors in Morocco were even more wary of us than we were of them. Omar's upcoming criminal trial, along with the recent imprisonment of Mati Monjib and a handful of other journalists, was an uncomfortably tight turn of the screw by the Moroccan security services, meant to send a message. In the lead-up to Omar's arrest, his family, friends, and colleagues had all been subject to various forms of intimidation and unwanted publicity. Every journalist in the country, and there aren't that many left, is scared of being targeted next, one Moroccan reporter said. The news about Omar, I have to admit, also rattled a lot of folks at Forbidden Stories and the security lab. We had a recent and pertinent history with him. Omar Radi, or Omar Radi's iPhone, had been crucial to helping the security lab build its forensic tool. Well before the Pegasus Project began in earnest, because of Omar's friendship and professional relationship with Mati Monjib, Claudio and Danica had asked if they could have a look inside his mobile device. The evidence of Pegasus infection inside Omar's phone was strong enough that the security lab had decided to release the findings. Forbidden Stories, along with a number of our media partners, had been granted the inside story by Omar himself. We timed our publications to coincide with the release of the security lab's report on June 22, 2020. The publication had an immediate effect, but not the one we anticipated. Omar Radi's personal story turned out to be an almost pure distillation of Claudio Guarnieri's warning that any technology bestowed as a tool of liberation could also be turned into a tool of repression. The transformation in Morocco unfolded over a decade, and Omar was at the center of it from beginning to end. He experienced the euphoria of initial discovery, the grinding effort of making new technology work on behalf of freedom, equality, and dignity, and the awful blowback when the state turned that technology against him. Omar's first glimmers of the power of social media came as early as 2008, when he and his friends discovered they could prank the always watchful Moroccan gendarmerie. Omar was a 22-year-old business reporter at a local radio station with a growing reputation as an activist agitating for democratic reform. He and his closest compatriots knew they were being watched and used it to their advantage. We sent each other a text message like, "Protest in front of the police headquarters at 6 p.m., he told us. The proposed demonstration was a hoax, but the feint caused the local police to expend a lot of unnecessary time and energy. It was a loop of about 8 people who sent this SMS to each other, and at 6 p.m., when the time came, we were just milling around, smoking a cigarette next to the police headquarters, and there were police vans filling the whole place." The real potential of this new technology became clear a few years later, when the self-immolation of a street vendor, Mohamed Bouazizi, sparked democracy protests in Tunisia. Social media apps fed an unprecedented wildfire of demonstrations across the Arab world. Laptops and cell phones were the preferred weaponry of the movement. People found they could communicate and organize in relative secrecy on Facebook and Twitter. They leveraged this new reality to inform and encourage protesters who were demanding a more democratic society and governance that answered to the needs of the entire citizenry. Freedom of expression was no longer the dream of some unforeseeable future in the Arab street. It was actually happening. The listening circle of anti-regime bloggers and vloggers grew wider and wider. Nobody in power appeared to know how to wriggle this genie back in the bottle. In the face of the unrelenting protests, and with the world now watching, the Tunisian president ceded power in January 2011 after a quarter century in office. A month later, with men, women, and children occupying Cairo's Tahrir Square and refusing to cede ground, the seemingly inviolable regime of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak crumbled. 9 days later, the February 20 movement was birthed in Morocco. Omar was in his glory. In spite of the dangers presented by the police and security officers who carried their batons into the protests and used them to crack heads. The movement in Morocco, Omar explained, was a rally for all those left outside the public space who wished to reclaim that space, democratize it, and transform it into a genuine avenue of debate. He kept busy organizing protests, reporting them to the wider world, and spurring fellow movement leaders with what others described as his contagious optimism. Omar occasionally exhibited the rhetorical excess that comes with youth and ideological ardor. "The only dictators that won't fall are the ones who are already dead," he once exclaimed to a group of protesters and journalists who had gathered to rehash the day's events. But underlying the February 20 movement was a very sophisticated awareness of political imperatives and political limitations. Omar and his fellow leaders weren't calling for the head of King Mohammed VI. They were calling on him to lead the way to reform, to give up some of his nearly absolute power. They were asking for a parliament that answered to the people and not the king, for a judiciary independent of the king. They asked for an end to the system of economic privilege that funneled public wealth to the top and encouraged corruption among government officials. They wanted a constitution that enshrined as a matter of law freedom of association, freedom of expression, and closest to Omar's heart, freedom of the press. King Mohammed VI sounded willing to meet them halfway. The Moroccan sovereign was a clever man with a keen appreciation for public relations. He had always kept one eye on his standing at home and another on his standing in the Western world, and had worked hard to cultivate an image of monarchical liberality from the day he took the throne. Back in the first year of his reign, in 2000, he had handled a reporter visiting from Time magazine with remarkable deftness. The front door of the palace opens, and out comes King Mohammed VI with a feline bounce in his step, was the almost breathless lead in Time. The correspondent fairly gushed over the new leader of Morocco.
his English proved to be impeccable and only slightly accented. The king, noted the reporter, was the same regular guy he had been when he was merely the crown prince. The 36-year-old monarch strapped on his Nikes and went for a jog. He drove himself to the office, even stopped at red lights like everybody else. He smoked Marlboros, he raced jet skis, he plunged like a pop star into crowds of adoring Moroccans. This sovereign intended to meet the people and see how they live, the new king explained. When I wave at people, I try not to greet the crowd, but to greet people individually, to make eye contact. King Mohammed VI, Tom reported, had even begun to make amends for the cruelty his father, King Hassan II, had visited upon subjects who crossed him. While Hassan II held sway, dissidents were likely to end up in prison or dead. Mohammed VI, or M6, as he came to be called, had made a public display of releasing some of these accused heretics. Mohammed VI is modern, said one of the pardoned men. He does not have an authoritarian disposition. The magazine ran its 1,700-word profile under the headline, "The King of Cool, Mohammed VI is the Beatles of Arabian royalty." No surprise, 11 years later, M6 handled the uprisings of the Arab Spring with publicity in mind. The men and ministers who served him, the king suggested, were perhaps to blame for the regrettable state of affairs that existed between the monarch and his people. On March 9, 2011, less than 3 weeks after protests began, the king went on television to tell his subjects he was appointing a committee to draft constitutional reforms that answered to the concerns of the protesters. He began to release political dissidents who had been imprisoned in his own reign. The demonstrations didn't subside, but the beatings by the kingdom's police forces did. By the time the Moroccan people ratified the proposed constitutional reforms in July, Mohammed VI was being hailed by some for his move toward democratization. There were critics inside Morocco who pointed out that the king's power wasn't much clipped by the updated constitution. The sovereign still chose the prime minister, and he still ruled the highest court in Morocco, and he still appointed most of the judges. But the reforms did look good on paper, especially from afar. M6 was lauded for his accommodation and his relatively bloodless handling of the crisis. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called the king's reforms a model for the Arab world, as did French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé. The Kingdom of Morocco continued to enjoy the financial beneficence of the West. In 2013, the EU topped off its annual grant of $250 million in cash assistance with an additional $40 million to help the kingdom with its democratic transition. That same year, President Barack Obama praised Morocco for its newfound commitment to human rights. The U.S. continued to gift the kingdom more than $100 million a year to help stimulate the Moroccan economy. Those years immediately following the February 20 movement turned into the salad days for Omar Radi. He became a key blogger for Mamkavench, roughly translated, no concession, a citizen journalist site that debunked state-financed and state-run media. He helped launch the French version of the website specializing in investigative reporting, lacombe.com. He contributed to foreign media outlets like Orient XXI, the BBC, and Al Jazeera English. He was also a founding member of Le Desk, a news site that specialized in long-format investigative reporting, multimedia presentations, and data journalism. The palace, meanwhile, was becoming even more committed to blunting the impact of any press unfriendly to the state or the sovereign. The Moroccan government shelled out good money to media companies as a neat little quid pro quo. Being a parrot for the kingdom was a much more secure and lucrative business proposition than trying to challenge the government line or report the truth. It also promised juicy scoops from sources inside the security services. There was a certain amount of harassment that went along with the work of independent journalism in Morocco, and a certain amount of financial hardship, which Omar Radi felt personally. Along with those of other well-known members of Mamfakench, his computer was infected by hacking team's remote control system spyware as early as 2012. His computer was so effed up, he remembers, he had to stop using it. The startup media companies that employed him in Morocco were occasionally censored, or run out of business, or drained of advertising revenue by the command of the state. From time to time,
Omar was forced to accept financial help from his parents. But a young man who had watched his father and mother get up at 5 o'clock every morning to drive to their high school teaching jobs in Casablanca, a waterfront city they could not yet afford to live in, had little fear of hardship and hard work. From 2012 to 2016, Omar Radi was able to do some really exceptional journalism, specializing in investigations that laid bare the workings of the Makhzen, the powerful state-sponsored cabal that controlled the distribution of Morocco's wealth and natural resources. His first big story was a five-part exposé of Morocco's sand and gravel industry, which provided raw materials needed in construction. The quarries were one of the few revenue-generating enterprises in Morocco, but the opportunity to invest in these lucrative businesses was a privilege held tight by the palace. The kingdom granted cuts of the earnings to the chosen. The profits, Omar found and reported, rarely redounded to the advantage of the citizenry. The money often ended up in banks in Luxembourg and the British Virgin Islands, beyond the reach of the tax collector in Morocco. Omar's second big investigative piece became known as The Affair of the Servants of the State. Omar got access to Morocco's public land register, cold sales contracts, tax exemptions, and deeds, and found that the state was selling off some of the most expensive acreage in the capital city of Rabat to friends of the monarchy and loyal bureaucrats who had served the state well. Omar named names, and he named prices. These investigations drew some attention to the young reporter and his first professional accolades, and not much real pushback from the authorities. But there were folks in the Moroccan security services who marked Omar Radi a man, as they would sometimes say, of wayward subjects, lacking due respect to the king. Omar would always say he meant no disrespect to the king, and that he never saw his relationship to the sovereign as one of personal antagonism. He was just out to tell the truth about his native country in hopes of making it better. Some of your colleagues find your journalism too investigative and too radical, one friend later said to Omar. But I remember when we used to laugh, saying that as long as we disturb them, those who really hold power, then it means we were on the right track. On paper, again, things were still getting better for independent-minded journalists in Morocco as late as 2016. According to the new legal code adopted that year, a reporter could no longer be sent to prison just for writing something that offended the state or the sovereign. But in Omar's experience, the kingdom was starting to lean in on extra-legal tactics when challenged. Omar had contracted with Le Monde to investigate a fascinating bit of inter-royalty gifting in the Middle Atlas city of Ifrane. The Kingdom of Morocco had apparently handed over a huge swath of publicly owned land to the Emir of Qatar so he could build himself a private mountaintop palace. Construction had already begun by the time Omar got on the story. The land was being deforested, the locals sent packing. Omar was trying to find out how this property deal had been done. Had the dispossessed townsfolk signed off on this? Were they compensated? Omar could tell he was being followed by government minders from the moment he got to the region, and he noticed how quickly the local leaders and activists cooled on the idea of talking to him. My conversations with the people, with the activists on the spot, etc., were well monitored, he says. Omar reported back to Le Monde that the story didn't seem doable, that the kingdom was going to keep putting sticks in my wheels. The editors in Paris weren't willing to give up, and Omar might have pushed ahead until a sovereign-friendly website jumped on the story. Not the story of the Qatari's new palace, but the story of Omar's investigation. My telephone conversations, especially, ended up on a news site called Le 360, which was also close to the government and which told of my intentions in the article, Omar says. I ended up abandoning the idea of doing that investigation because the threat was direct and clear not to get close to this kind of subject. The next year, while reporting on the land dispossession in the Rif region of Morocco, Omar was arrested and held for 48 hours. The Rif was a dangerous place to be in 2017, but also where the best stories were. The people of the region were a forgotten population, poor and poorly educated. But they were proud and showed little willingness to be docile subjects of any king, not of Mohammed V or his son Hassan II or his son Mohammed VI. The ill will was often reciprocated.
Hassan II called them dirty, ignorant beggars. After the killing of a local fish vendor in the Rif in 2016, police looked on when he was crushed by a garbage compactor as he attempted to retrieve $10,000 worth of his confiscated swordfish. The region erupted in violent demonstrations that recalled the Arab Spring 5 years earlier. King Mohammed VI quickly turned the region into a police state, pouring cops into the main cities, one for every two citizens in some places. The police used batons, truncheons, and firearms with impunity, and even, some suspected, with relish. People were jailed by the hundreds over the next few years. Leaders of the protest movement were sentenced to 20-year prison terms. When those sentences were upheld on appeal, Omar's sense of injustice got the better of him. Let us all remember appeals judge Lassin Tolfi, the enforcer against our brothers, he tweeted in April 2019. In many regimes, small-time henchmen like him come back begging later, claiming they were only carrying out orders. No forgetting or forgiveness with such undignified officials. Omar was arrested for sending that message, interrogated by the National Brigade of Judicial Police, BNPJ, for 5 hours and released. 8 months later, without warning, Omar was arrested again for the same offense. He was held without bail and in solitary confinement for a week and finally charged with insulting a magistrate. In March 2020, he was convicted and sentenced to 4 months in prison, suspended. One of the Moroccan government's well-subsidized media sites called it light. Sandrine and Cecile first interviewed Omar Radi 3 months later, in June 2020, as the security lab was finalizing its report, concluding that Omar had likely been a victim of Pegasus cyber surveillance spyware. Omar was in remarkably good spirits. He said he was looking forward to seeing how the Moroccan authorities answered the charge. The contagious optimism that his February 20 movement compatriots had seen a decade earlier was hard to miss. Omar was quick to smile, and quick with a joke. Even by remote hookup, you could see the twinkle in his eyes. Omar seemed amused and slightly bewildered that the Kingdom of Morocco had chosen this moment to give him, 12 years after he had first applied, his official press credentials. He told us he was appealing his 4-month prison sentence, but was not entirely hopeful. Given the way they are behaving toward me through the press right now, I think they are a little angry with me, he said. I guess we'll see. Meanwhile, he couldn't wait to tell us about an ambitious new investigation he was working on, which involved the transfer of millions of acres of land in the course of King Mohammed's 20-year rule. Omar told us that in one case, it appeared the kingdom had bought land from rural Moroccans for as little as 2.5 euros per square meter, and then sold it to real estate developers for about 1,500 euros per square meter. His enthusiasm for this new investigation into land dispossession seemed unbounded, probably because it was a culmination of a dozen years of work and study on his part. This operation aims to take out the land that is considered as dormant capital, according to the official language. That is, land used for producing food and so on, and to inject it into the market, he told us. Millions of dispossessed families who have only agricultural skills ended up on the outskirts of urban centers because they have nowhere else to go. The state drives them out so that, afterward, the state can give this land to the private sector to build golf courses, luxury houses, condominiums, that kind of thing. It's hard to see public utility there. This is about the impoverishment of the population, which suffers both the greed of the private sector under the protection of the authorities, the justice system, the police, and the Ministry of Interior, who are ganging up against a population that has already for decades been the victim of the lack of literacy policy, public schools, health, and general impoverishment due to the general conditions of the country's economic policies. The investigation was neither fast, nor easy, nor cheap, but Omar was back at the desk and had just received additional funding in the form of a grant from an international foundation specializing in journalism, economic justice, and human rights. Omar was determined to keep at this investigation because he had come to see it as a crime in progress. The Moroccan state lacks financial resources at the moment, he said. Land is a financial resource that can easily be taken away from people and is of great value. I think that the phenomenon of land appropriation will multiply in the coming years. There was one catch to his plan to complete the project, he admitted. He suspected the government had caught wind of it. Something pretty shocking happened at the beginning of this year, he said. I finished investigating with a village, and I did some interviews with the members of the village, the people there, the inhabitants, the peasants. And then I received calls from all the members of the village 2 days later saying, please don't talk about us. Don't quote us. I was threatened by the police. You're going to get us in trouble if you ever publish an article. When Cecile and Sandrine got down to the discussion about his being surveilled by somebody in Morocco using Pegasus, he was philosophical. Cyber surveillance had been a fact of life for journalists in Casablanca and Rabat. We are in a police state where one of the tools for controlling the public space is to have people under surveillance, Omar explained. And among those people under surveillance, there are people like me, like political activists, like journalists, who are disturbing, who must be systematically monitored. Omar figured he'd been watched since the Arab Spring. Moroccans were already using the Eagle cyber surveillance system from the French company Amesis back in 2011, and later RCS from Hacking Team, and Finn Fisher from the Gamma Group, and now Pegasus from NSO. He was surprised to hear from the security lab about the clever new zero-click technology NSO had developed to launch a spyware attack. The NSO virus is much more advanced, Omar said. They're cutting edge. They know everything. Hats off to them. In the previous few days, Omar had begun to sense new activity in the campaign against him. It appeared to him that the Moroccan security services were feeding material about him to their paid media mouthpieces, that whoever had gained access to the contents of his cell phone was using that information as a weapon against him. Government-friendly media outlets were beginning to publish details of Omar's personal life that he took pains to keep private. He called the tactic barbouzerie, a French slang term that refers to shady spy tactics. That is to say, Omar explained, telling exactly what time I was drinking alcohol, or with whom I live, who comes to my house, etc. In a barbouzerie press article, they are letting you know you are being watched. Omar had good reason to be concerned about this new development. Barbouzerie in Morocco had taken a dark turn in the previous few years, one that had put the practitioners of independent journalism on edge. The king's prosecutors had used a series of salacious criminal charges to decimate the staff at Akhbar al-Youm, a newspaper that refused to toe the government line. The paper's founder and editor-in-chief, Taufik Basrin, had been arrested in 2018, a few days after he wrote an opinion piece criticizing the king's chosen prime minister for neglecting critical infrastructure in rural Morocco. The public prosecutor of Casablanca charged Basrin with multiple counts of sexual assault. One of Basrin's purported victims, also an employee of Akhbar al-Youm, refused to corroborate the allegations. I testified that he was innocent, she said. The prosecutor did not like that, and somehow convinced the judge that I was suffering from Stockholm syndrome. She fled to Tunisia, with a 6-month sentence for perjury and defamation hanging over her head. Basrin was convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison. The editor-in-chief who replaced Basrin, Soleimane Rossouni, was also charged with sexual assault and jailed. Rossouni's niece, Jar, a reporter at Akhbar al-Youm, was arrested with her fiancé while leaving her gynecologist's office. The king's prosecutors charged the couple with engaging in premarital sex and terminating a pregnancy, both criminal acts in Morocco. The trial required the 28-year-old Rossouni to submit to an unwanted and unnecessary gynecological examination. It was an inhuman experience. Imagine a doctor forcibly inserting instruments into your vagina without your consent, Hajar told reporters from the French publications Mediapart and L'Humanité. I was raped by the Moroccan state. On top of that, Omar told us, they falsified documents because in the end, the expert said there was no abortion. Hajar, her fiancé, and the doctor, who was falsely accused of performing an abortion, were all convicted and sentenced to prison. When the king issued a royal decree of clemency 6 weeks later, so the couple could begin a family in accordance with religious precepts and the law, Hajar fled to Sudan with her fiancé. She felt compelled to write letters of apology to the gynecologist and his staff, who were also convicted of crimes. The newspaper she and her uncle had worked for was on life support by June 2020. "That's how they operate," Omar told us. "It's breaking people's image, digging up things about them, and making them public. There are no ethics, no morals. We're going to expose sexual orientation. We're going to take paparazzi pictures of someone with his mistress or a woman with her lover. And we're going to publish it to say, look, she's cheating on her boyfriend or he's cheating on his girl, etc. Which is none of their business." When Sandrine and Cecile had a second talk with Omar the following week, just 5 days before publication, he was becoming suspicious that Moroccan government authorities were softening the ground for a personal attack to discredit him. The regime-friendly gossip sites had just a few days earlier published details about Omar's roommate, his girlfriend, and even specific details of the money going into and out of his personal bank accounts. The sort of information somebody with access to Omar's iPhone could mine. More worrisome, a popular gossip site called Chauf TV had accused Omar of acting as a spy for a foreign government, called him a cannabis smoker, and asserted he had a reputation among his young activist friends as a rapist. On June 22, 2020, Forbidden Stories posted the story of the Pegasus attack on Omar Radi, along with our partners from Le Monde, The Guardian, Süddeutsche Zeitung, and The Washington Post. We were unable to include a comment from the Moroccan government, which refused to answer our queries or even deign to acknowledge receipt. Omar may have been disappointed there was no official response, but he sent us a message of thanks that day. "Makes a lot of noise here," he said. "It is awesome." 2 days later, Omar was summoned to the BNPJ offices in Casablanca, where the prosecutors were already busy. Somebody there had alerted Chauf TV so its cameras could be on hand to record Omar's perp walk, and the King's prosecutor had ready a press release about the reason for the summons. "It's official," Omar wrote to us that afternoon after suffering through a 6-hour interrogation. "They were accusing me of working with foreign intelligence agencies. They are pushing the ridiculousness very far." Our key partners did follow up stories on the arrest with statements from Omar and the Moroccan authorities. The Washington Post was able to tag to the end of its report a not-so-veiled official threat from the Moroccan embassy in D.C. "Due to the short notice," a spokeswoman wrote, "we are unable to comment other than to underline that we reserve the right to pursue legal action in case any unverified or false information is published on this particular case." Omar retained his sense of humor. "We'll either see each other again in a few hours," he had told a friend on his way into his interrogation, "or maybe in 5 years." And his defiance. "I'm not afraid of anything," he said for publication. "I'm going with my head held high." Omar was summoned for another interrogation the following week. Investigators grilled him about the grant he had received from the South African Foundation to help fund his land appropriation investigation, and then leaked to one of their preferred Moroccan media outlets the identity of Omar's make-believe handler from MI6 in London. 3 days later, Omar and a friend were arrested for confronting and taking video of a Chauf TV cameraman who'd been following him around, recording him and a friend, and taunting them. After the ensuing quarrel, the police arrested Omar and his friend and held them in jail overnight. The prosecutor's office added to Omar's docket new charges of public drunkenness and capturing images without consent. He sounded weary and maybe a little afraid 2 days later, on July 8, when he sent Sandrine an audio file to catch us up on the latest harassment. "I'm sorry it's going to make you more work," he said. The tone of his voice was so different from usual. It was the first time I ever heard him sound despairing. "I don't know. Anyway, what I wanted to tell you is that 3 summonses in 2 weeks is too much. It's too much. The authorities in Morocco have a grudge against me, and they are using all their tools, the police, the media, and the justice system." Omar said he was beginning to believe that NSO was in on it too. If Morocco branded Omar a spy, NSO and Moroccan officials could both say that Pegasus was being used legitimately to protect national security. We kept telling Omar, as we had from the start,
that we would help keep his story alive and in the news so at least the prosecutors in Morocco understood they were being watched. You can count on us, we told him. But we were helpless, and the mood around the office was tense. Omar went dark in the middle of July. Sometime between his fifth interrogation and his seventh, he simply stopped responding to our messages. On July 29, 2020, we read the news that Omar had been picked up and remanded to pretrial detention. The investigation had taken on a new dimension. He was now facing charges of accepting money from foreign intelligence services, undermining state security, and rape. The alleged victim of sexual assault, a freelance employee at L'Edesk, went public a few days later. Her story of the assault was detailed and compelling. Omar's family and supporters made a point to say that nobody in the Radi camp wanted to silence the alleged victim, but that Omar deserved a fair trial, with all the evidence on the table. 9 months later, with the Pegasus Project beginning to get some traction in Mexico, India, and Hungary, Omar remained unreachable. He was still in jail and headed for trial, but with little hope of being able to mount a real defense. He had occasional visits from his friends and his parents, but we had heard that some of the old twinkle had gone out of Omar's eyes. Each of us had forbidden stories, and the security lab was feeling varying degrees of guilt for having shined a light a bit too brightly on Omar Radi, for having invited the full force of the Moroccan state down on his head. One of our staffers at Forbidden Stories was so shaken that she spoke about leaving the field of journalism. Sandrine and I tried to explain to her, as we tried to explain to ourselves, that the job of a reporter is not to advocate or to push for a certain outcome. A journalist's job is to tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. But this was cold comfort where Omar was concerned for all of us. He had bravely and openly shared his story with us, and when the walls started to close in on him, there was not a lot we could do. The case of Omar was an important lesson to understand, Claudia would say. Things can go wrong, even for the people we tried to help.